for me.
Well, her watch says it's 8:30, so we have plenty of time. Let me pray for you, Norma. Lord, I know you prepared Norma's heart. She has a full heart fixed on you. Anoint her afresh by your Spirit. Use her message to encourage us and to enlighten us. And God be exalted. I know that's the cry of her heart. Be glorified, Lord. In Jesus, we ask it in your name. Amen.
You know, there's thinkers and feelers in this world, and I'm a feeler. And so it's harder to come up with hard things when you're in front of people if you're someone who feels emotion easily. So I feel like I'm at a precipice, and I'm going to jump off, and there's no return. I do feel like going through this door today, you will see me differently. You will see people in my story differently, and it's not going to be the same, but that's not bad necessarily. You know, there is a time for everything, and I do think it is the right time. A year and a half ago, I was sitting over here, and I was looking at the people in the congregation here, and I was thinking about some of your needs. And I was frustrated because people would come to me, and they would unload, you know, and I had answers, but you can't answer in a short way. My frustration was I could not really give them what they needed in 5 minutes. Because the things I have learned have taken a long time. I've been that tree by the water that Psalm 1 talks about, and for a long time I've been growing in Him. And that the lessons of freshness have really been in the last 5 years where I have experienced healing. You know, I was lost in a world I didn't understand. It was a frustrating world because in the choices I made, I usually made the harder choice. The choice of forgiveness, and that's a hard one, or to just go on. And I wouldn't give in to things. I always just kept going. And what you do is you do put a shell around you. It's the only way you can function. And I didn't understand why, if I was obedient, why things still kept happening in my life, because I tried to do it right. I am fairly private, and so I'm sharing things today I've never shared with people, actually, except a couple people, and my family are the only ones who know some of this. As I've thought through it, when I first asked if I could speak, was after sitting there, I was thinking, you know, there's so much I've learned that could help people, and there's a forum for that, and that would be from here. So I asked Pastor if I could speak. Soon after that, things started happening, and I kind of went into a depression, and I just was like, oh, I'm not as far along as I thought I was. I am not ready. And then I regretted that I had said anything, because I thought I could come up here and tell you the solution without telling you the problem. But what I have come to see is that God can use it more if I tell you the problem. Because we all have problems. None of us have lived here on this earth that long without something major in our lives. And in my sharing, I think there enough has happened in my life that you can identify at some point. You may have been the perpetrator, or you may have been the receiver. And the solution is the same. That's the exciting part. The solution is found in God. But the thing we fail to tell people, which I have failed to hear, was that it's not just asking God to help you. It's not just being obedient. It isn't just adding on. It is giving Him preeminence. It was letting go, and it was saying, I can't do this anymore. You're going to have to do it. I had been hurt at work, so I'd been let go twice. And, you know, things like, it wasn't just my things at home. It was other things that also hurt me. I want you to see God. I don't want you to see me. I want you to see the solution, that it is looking in the mirror at who you are That's where it starts. If you don't ever do that, you'll never have victory. Because if you can't see who you are, then God can't minister through you. You know, it's not about you get saved and you have a good life. That's not how it is. We aren't saved to have a good life. We're saved to be a reflection of God. And we get that backwards. We think He'll give us a good life. You know, the world is hurting. It's dying. And if we aren't the reflection of God's glory to everyone, not just the obedient few, you know, we can't be that light that shines out, then we really aren't genuine. So what I had to do 5 years ago was look in that mirror, and I wanted to. I was tired of suffering. But I have to lead you to that point, and you're going to see who I am. I am a storyteller. It's one thing I love to do is tell stories with students. And, you know, most stories have something you have to solve. And then there's a resolution in my stories that way, too. If you've been here in our church 6 or 7 years ago, you would have seen my family. There would have been my husband, me, and our 5 children, ages 3 through 17. And we were very active in the church. I was doing women's ministries, children's church, Awana. Randy did Awana. He taught the junior high. But there were deep problems in our marriage. Always had been. Always seemed to be. And people saw us as a very nice family. And we were a nice family. But there were problems. And when the marriage, when Randy left, it not only affected my family, it affected the church. I remember, like LaVon, when she told Tiffany, Tiffany started crying and said, well, if it can happen to your family, it could happen to our family. So there are repercussions. 5 years ago, it was February of 2002 when Randy left. A week after he left, I decided I had to start changing some things in me. I was so full of bitterness and resentment because I had given so much to try to make it work. I thought one thing I could do is start journal writing. The first thing I did was I wrote this prayer. And this is why I'm sharing today, because I'm fulfilling a vow I made. The prayer was, Gracious Father, work on my heart and my mind. Help me to learn to listen. Help me to push past my fear and to have eyes to see. I want to see Jesus. I'm going to need some water, I think. Thank you. May my reality adjust and readjust as my vision for you changes and my vision for God has changed tremendously. May I see you alone. May the work you are doing in me be used outwardly to minister to others. I seek you and you alone. So what I did is I started having a heart for God that I never had before. It was almost a passion. I just wanted Him. I lost my job. I mean, I had 3 more months and the job was over. So I was unemployed. I no longer had a husband. I had no security. I figured I'd get cancer next. You know, I knew something bad was coming next. And it was like, what else can go wrong? The kids were sad and unhappy, angry, and I let them be. I just thought they had to get it out too. And they were looking at why, what did Mom do wrong? You know, or, you know, what went wrong? Thank you so much. And so it just seemed like I lost everything. And I had no, you know, I had the orchard income, but, you know, I just started searching, and you know what the neat thing is? God knew. And having that year off is when I started seeking Him. I would spend 3 or 4 hours a day in the Word, or in praying, or walking in the orchard, and just communing, and that's when healing started to happen. But I want to tell you about that later. Right now, I really do need to tell you about my life. It really started before I was even born. I'm from a long Christianity tradition in the family, and more of conservative Christianity. As a child, we were Grace Brethren, our Church of the Brethren, both in the family. Both my sets of grandparents were saved. And in fact, on the Brumbaugh side, my father's side, there are many people. You know, we've had college presidents. We've had, we have people who've done a lot of things, and they've all been Christians, or for the most part. And that tradition was so much ingrained in our lives that we didn't add Christianity into our lives. It was our life. I mean, our whole, we went through that filter, or that looking through the glass as a Christian looks. It was in the very fiber of our beings. I'm not going to take time to talk about my grandparents, except to say on both sides, they were very significant in my life, and especially my mom's mother, because she was very musical, and she gave us the gift of music. We always had to sing. She also showed us how to give to others. We would go sing. You know, my sisters and I would go to rest homes and sing. We were little. I was 7, 6, something like that. And we'd be singing, and then later Mom carried on that tradition by making sure that we sang in the church, played the piano and all that. Grandma also wrote music, and I do think a lot of my giftedness comes from her. In my family unit, I have to pick now. In my own family, there are 5 of us kids. I was the middle child, the compliant one, of course. The middle child usually is, you know, and the peacemaker. I think of my siblings as all very talented, but I never thought of myself as talented. I was very, very shy. And my sister, who is a missionary today, was always leading her friends to the Lord. I mean, even at 9 years old, she knew she wanted to be a missionary. And then my next sister was so musical. She was playing. She was accompanying in church when she was in 7th grade. And she had so much music in her. And then there was me. And then there was my brother, who had a lot of tenacity and intelligent. And I looked up to him a lot, and not when we were kids, though. But. And then there was my sister, Lois, who had perfect pitch, could have made a great musician, did well with her life, 4.0 type person. Dad was a farmer, and we grew up working on the farms. I'm telling you the background, because you have to understand this. We grew up working on the farm. That's what we did after school. That's what we did on weekends. Not every afternoon, but enough that we didn't do sports. In our family, this is the part I want you to get, there were certain codes. I don't really remember them being voiced much. And some of you will identify with some of these because they're part of you. They're still part of me, and I've tried to emulate them with my own children. Be truthful, obey God, treat people right, be humble, be kind, be responsible, work hard, and not only work hard, do it well. And think things through before you act. That one has really been something I've done a lot, sometimes too much. So when we'd screw up on the farm, we'd mess up. Dad would want us, you know, a lot of times he was working in a different field than we were. He'd want us to try to figure out the problem without us having to him to come fix it and wasting a lot of time. So we learned to think things through. I was saved at age 7 at home with Mom. At age 16, I went to Pilot Lake Camp, and that's when God started really working in me. I can remember I started crying one night, and it was in the afternoon, actually, and I just felt this burden, because there were several young people in our youth group who were kind of doing their own thing. I was kind of concerned about them, and I just started crying about sin. And you know how you go through life for a while wondering if God really is real? I used to think, well, am I Christian, or is he really real? At that point, that question was answered, and I don't know why. It's not true of everyone, but for me, I never doubted God that God was there after that. I've never really wanted to go away from him. Oh, I'm going to tell you about my church a little. It was a very strict church, what we would probably term legalistic today. Although I don't think they meant it bad. You know, you're wanting to live a good, pure, good life. Yeah. I mean, everyone tries, but I did notice something that has come round circle now that I understand a lot better. I would notice that people who at some point would turn away they would usually go way to the other side. And they'd get really into deep things. And I'd think, well, why don't they just, you know, not come to church anymore, but still live an okay life? But they'd go way the other way, and then we'd all pray that they'd get back to the Lord. Then they'd come back, and then it might happen again. That's some of what Pastor's been talking about. Why is that? You know, and the problem is the church shoots their wounded a lot. And I have to say I participated in that. You don't even know you're doing it. You know, you kind of look down your noses at people who aren't living it right. And so that factored in. Then I went away to Christian college, and it was wonderful. I got to date Christian guys, and that was wonderful. And it really set me up for a good life, because when you're in Christian college, it is kind of a protected environment, but you also learn a lot about the Bible that's never taught in church. I didn't realize how little I knew about the Bible till I went to Bible college. I really had no foundation. In good stead for me, because I can spot error that I wouldn't have spotted if I hadn't had that background. Then when I left college, I came home and taught at Paradise Christian School. I've been dating a guy for 3 years from college, and we were kind of on the end of that. And that's when I met Randy. And I had to take a class because I was just two classes shy of getting my diploma. And so I met Randy, and we got acquainted. He was a new believer. He'd become saved at Fort Lewis in the Army through a very, very, very legalistic church. He turned away from that, and he was kind of not sure what he was doing. I ended my friendship with my boyfriend, and then Randy and I started dating. And after the first date, I felt like he was the one for me. I just felt that, but we were couldn't have been more different backgrounds. All those things I told you were traditions in my family were not in his life at all. In fact, there was really no guiding principles in his life. He was from a very dysfunctional background. Well, we did get married. I was 25 when we got married, and I was pure. I was still a virgin. That was important to me. But it also factors in the story why later things happened that I didn't understand. In 1981, my sister Marilyn, who lives in Oregon, she'd been married a few years, she had a baby girl. This baby girl's name was Sharon Elizabeth. Sharon Elizabeth was one of those just beautiful babies, creamy white skin, dark brown eyes, and black hair. You know, and she was just a gorgeous baby. My parents' first grandchild. Well, here's where the first really hard thing happened. When she was 11 months old, Marilyn called us and said that Sharon hadn't been well, that her body was swelling, and they found out she had leukemia. 10 days later, she was gone. You know, we didn't even have time to adjust to that. You know, you're praying about the chemotherapy. And so I was 6 months pregnant with Josh when this happened, and we made the trip to Oregon, and my sister Marilyn is just the opposite of me. She doesn't show much emotion. And we sat in their living room, and they told us about Sharon's last days, how sick she had been, and how hard it had been to get her to take her medicine. And then Marilyn told about when she died, how that morning the sun was shining, and it, after days of rain, you know how Oregon is. Dan said, I wonder if Sharon will go home to glory, because it's just like the day she was born. And later on, Marilyn went in, and she wasn't breathing, and they gave her CPR, and that's how it ended. My sister, her voice caught at that point, and she couldn't go on. And then we went and viewed Sharon, and she was so beautiful, and it just didn't seem fair. It didn't seem fair to me, because they were some of the best people. It didn't seem fair that my parents wouldn't have their first grandchild either. We went home, and of course, then Josh was born that summer, and I loved being a mother. That's really what I'd always wanted to be. Randy had gone from job to job already, even though we hadn't been married very long. But I didn't care if we didn't have anything. I wanted to stay home with my baby. And so I no longer taught school. And, you know, we survived. It really was a lot about survival. When Josh was a year old, Randy, one day, it was like a Saturday, I think, he was home. And he said, Norma, he says, I don't think it's working out. I'm going to leave. I mean, just like that. No emotion. No, I'm sorry. You know, I guess it's not working out. I said, what? And I couldn't believe it, really, because I never viewed marriage that way, as something you walk away from. For me, it was about for my life. And I wasn't a very secure person in those days at all. And I begged him not to leave. And I cried and cried, and he didn't leave. But it was kind of a shaky start. We managed to somehow get through that, and it wasn't long that I was pregnant with LaVon. And, you know, like I said, we didn't have a lot, and, you know, the job, there were a couple of job changes even in that pregnancy, so we didn't have health insurance either, so we had to pay for these babies ourselves. Was not a small thing. She was born, and of course, you know, LaVon, she came out crying. She was, Josh has always been mellow. She was the opposite, very determined, even as a baby. And I just really enjoyed my children. When LaVon was 14 months old, Randy and I went to his 10-year high school reunion in Oroville. And at the time, he acted really strange toward me. It was like when you have a boyfriend and they've lost interest in how they just don't want to spend time with you. They won't talk to you. He was that way. And he went visiting with all these people I'd never met, never introduced me. I thought, what's going on here? I felt abandoned. Well, the next day I knew why. He was working at Iron Skillet in Corning. He left at 6:30 in the morning. Yeah, the children and I went to church. When I came home from church, there was a note on the table, and I thought, that's odd. And he's supposed to be at work. And the note said, Norma, I can't do this anymore. I'm leaving. I know you'll be a good mom to the kids. And that was it. And he said something about how he was struggling. Look, you know, it was like, you know, your whole world changes. I didn't know where he was. The truck was there. The truck he drove. I didn't know if he was suicidal, because, you know, he was someone who became very detached right after we got married. He lived in his own world. The more I pursue him, the more he'd pull away. You know, I hadn't been able to connect with him emotionally very well. So I called my parents. They came right over. I called Randy's sisters. They came right over, and we stood in the living room and all held hands, and we prayed the Lord's Prayer. The worry was, is Randy suicidal? What's he doing? Where is he? What can we do? And, you know, none of us knew. So I called Army buddies I'd never met that I knew about, see if he'd gone to see them. No one had heard. I wondered what money he had. Saw a friend of mine from the bank, and she said she had waited on Randy and that he'd cashed our refund check. So then I knew what money he had. I had to go to Iron Skillet, turn in his keys, and that was so humbling. It was awful telling them, hey, Randy skipped, you know. And I didn't want to go to town. I didn't want to see anyone. I didn't want to say, oh, how's Randy? Because I couldn't talk. I was devastated. Nothing in my shelter life had prepared me for what I was facing. For 6 weeks, I didn't know where Randy was. My family would come. I can remember my brother coming, and we sat outside watching the kids play in the yard. Paul said, I really want to ask you a question, Norma. He says, it's kind of hard to ask. He said, why did you marry Randy instead of Dave, the guy I had gone with for 3 years? Because Dave had adored me. You know, I couldn't answer that very well, because I had known that Randy didn't love me like Dave had loved me. And so, you know, you just kind of look at your life and go, man, I sure blew it. And now I have two children who are suffering. Well, when I heard from Randy, it was in a postcard, and he said, I just want you to know I'm okay. He was in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He had bought a motorcycle and had ridden across the U.S., and he was working at a hotel on the ocean. Well, my brother-in-law said, Norma, this is Kirk, the missionary. They were on furlough. He goes, I'll go out and see him if you want me to. And you can come out then, too. I'll lay the path. And I said, sure. I wanted to know. I really wanted to know what was up. So Kirk did that. And then he called me and said, you know, I found Randy. And there's a Christian family out here that you can stay with. And, you know, he says he's got a lot of issues. Well, I kind of knew there were issues. I just didn't know what they were. So I flew out there. And we were both glad to see each other. I mean, you don't live with someone and not care about them. It was a very passionate time. But he shared stuff about himself that was hard to hear when you're a married woman. And I knew that the path, if we ever got back together, would not be easy. And so as we were together, I thought, he doesn't understand what I've been through these 6 weeks, not knowing where he was or what's going to happen to my children. No employment. I wasn't working. But he was so messed up. He had lost a lot of weight. You could just see the depression in his face, a darkness. And I just couldn't really tell him what I was going through. So the day I called home, and Mom said that the babies were missing me. And I thought, I've got to get home. Because, you know, we both were gone, you know, at that point. And so when I was ready to leave, I was on the airplane, and Randy was standing. I could see him. And I thought to myself, I wonder if I'll ever see him again. And it was an awful thought. But I didn't know. He had asked me to move out there. I knew that was not the solution. And so I came back home. Maybe a month later, Randy came home. He went to a Christian counselor. And when I came into the session, the counselor basically said, you know, Randy, she must love you a great deal to take you back after what you did. Yeah, he was trying to help Randy see things. But I think with his own pain, he could not see. It was a hard time, those few months, because now I didn't have trust anymore. And I didn't know if he'd leave me again. And I still wanted to stay home with the children. I didn't want to go to work. I fought that with my being. I mean, I could have gone to work, find someone to watch the babies. And then soon after that, I got pregnant again with Thomas. Now, that pregnancy was a hard pregnancy because of my emotional state. I was in sorrow. I really was sorrowing. And I worried that he wouldn't turn out right because of that. Because I thought he could probably get those vibes from me. And I think it's interesting how God works. Thomas is a very kind, gentle soul. And so he turned out okay. Anyway, I went to my brother's wedding when Thomas was about 4 months old. And when Paul and Kim, they got married in Palo Cedro, so we actually had moved up to Greenville for a job. So we came down to Chico to go to Paul's wedding. And when Paul and Kimberly got married, you could just see their love for each other. It just showed. There was just a tender look towards each other. I went home that night and I started crying. All I didn't have. But I made a decision. I decided to stay with it no matter what. And the worst was yet to come. When we moved to Greenville, it's because Randy had inherited some money and he invested it in a company in Chester. It was a transmission rebuilding company. It wasn't a solid company, but he did it anyway. He was their sales rep, and he would travel around. When he traveled around, you know, he was building the business, and the company did show some growth, but then it looked like they were going to have to shut their doors, and he was angry. Now, Randy was, like I said, a very depressed person, and I knew at times he was suicidal. And when I'd come down to Chico to visit my parents, when I'd drive home, I always had this fear that I'd get up there in the mountains to our home and he'd be dead. I didn't want the kids to see that. And so I lived with that fear. And, of course, the fear of abandonment. Well, when Thomas was 7 months old, one day Randy didn't come home from work. And I wondered, you know, you wonder. And I wonder the right thing. And so I called his partners, and they said, oh, he left early today. Well, he never did come home. And the next day on the police scanner, they found Randy's car by Lake Oroville with a note in it. And so the sheriff came out, and he wanted a description. He wanted a missing persons report. And he said, do you think he's suicidal? And I said, could be. I don't know. I just really don't know. And it was really hard. I just can't tell you how hard that was. Having three babies, you're kind of stuck. And then having the unknown out there and living up there. Well, the little church up there was really good to me. But they didn't know what to do either. And there was one man, though, who was wonderful. He was a man in a different church, and he said, when you hear from Randy, because I want to respond to him. He goes, because I want to show God. He says, I want to love him. Well, most people were just very angry at Randy that he could do that to me twice and that he couldn't care about his children. And I understand that. I understood that. I was angry too. But more than angry, I was hurt, just really deeply hurt. Well, then, this is the hard part to tell. I got this phone call at 9 o'clock in the morning, and it was a woman. And she said, is this Norma? And I said, yes. And she said, I got a note from Randy. I said, who is this? She goes, well, aren't you Randy's sister? And I said, no, I'm his wife. And she said, he said he wasn't married. Anyway, so we talked, and I realized that on his travels, he'd met her at a bar, and that they had started a friendship. That was the hardest thing I've ever experienced. I remember going into the bedroom after that call and saying, oh, God, no. Now I knew the difference between love and hate. Because I loved him, but I hated what he was doing to me. I really hated him. It was like he was destroying me. Yet I loved him, and I wanted him to be well. And then I started just searching the scripture. But I was broken-hearted. And where we lived was over the beautiful Huff Valley. And I would walk in the morning with Thomas in the stroller, Vaughn and Thomas to my side, and I would quote scripture. I lift my eyes to the hills from whence cometh my help. Didn't hear from Randy. I didn't know if he was alive. I really didn't know if he was alive. My family came up. They moved me back to Chico and into one of Dad's houses on the ranch. And I knew I had to find work. But I was not, you know, when you're emotionally, the last 2 years had been so much that I wasn't in a very good space. And so I can remember when I was applying at Little People's Nursery School, and you had to write a cover letter, and it's like it wrote itself. I mean, I didn't have it. God just helped me do it. And so I went to work, and that was hard. And we still haven't heard from Randy. Josh had his fifth birthday, and Josh became pretty sullen and withdrew. And when Randy first contacted, he was in Arizona this time. He contacted his grandparents first. He said, just let you know I'm okay. They came out to me at the ranch to tell me. And I didn't respond. I didn't do anything until he contacted me. When he contacted me, he had no intentions of ever returning. And he had no intentions of living the Christian life. He was mad at God because of the business going south, and just mad, you know. And I said, well, good, I don't want you to come back unless you get your life right, because the children don't need that kind of dad. And he was living like the world, which I'm sure you can imagine what it was. God gave him a Christian roommate down there who kept saying, Randy, you know what you're doing is wrong. You know you have a wife and kids. When he finally contacted me, you know, like I said, we talked to him, and I decided I was going to use tough love. you know, we're not going to get the thing back together again. How can I? Everyone was thinking that'd be this pretty foolish or stupid to do. You know, I thought that too, but I also knew my kids loved their dad. Well, this man from Greenville I mentioned contacted Randy. And I really think there's something about men that reached Randy. And when Randy started having a change of heart, I said, well, when you come, and he decided he wanted to come home. I said, well, we aren't going to live together. I said, we can't do this again. You know, things have to be different. So he did move back, moved in with some Christian friends of ours. I can still remember when he rode up on his motorcycle. I was nursing Thomas, and on the couch, and the kids, they ran out to see their daddy. It was hard. And then the question really was, can I take him back? Probably the hardest decision I've ever had to make. And I just knew I couldn't unless certain things were different. And I knew I'd have to forgive him. And I did. I forgave him. But I made the harder choice. I did take him back. And we were a family again, and you know, the next few months were really hard. We took in my niece who had problems. She was 12 years old, so I was working with that. And then we had something really strange happen in our home. One night, I really think it was demonic. There were things started happening in our house. Things were going off. The TV would come on, the microwave, the telephone would ring. All these bizarre things, not just once, just kept going on. And then Josh started screaming in deep pain. Three of the boys were all in the same room. And so we went in there, and Josh, he was doubled up with pain, screaming, but he was asleep. And so we prayed over him, and immediately went back to sleep, and Thomas started screaming. He went from one child to the next child. It's the same thing, the pain, the screaming, and we prayed over him, and he was sound asleep. We went back to bed, but I could not sleep. I was already frail emotionally from so much that it was just like it's what put me over. For weeks, I could not hardly sleep. I really think I had a nervous breakdown. Just too many things. And I had to quit my job. I'd never quit anything in my life. I had to quit my job. I didn't know if I ever could work again because I was almost agoraphobic. Anywhere I go, I feel sick the whole time. In church, just the fans going around, I couldn't look at them because it made me feel so shaky. Your nerves get frazzled, you know. And I couldn't sleep, which depleted me more. And emotionally, I was hurt. It was not a pretty place to be. And then Randy got a job up in Susanville. We moved to Westwood, and we were there 5 years. And that was really a slow recovery. We didn't have money to go to doctors, and so the only doctor I went to said, well, I think you need to see a psychiatrist. I think that's the problem, which probably was true. Because when you're going through a lot, it comes out physically. I would not be able to go to sleep till about 4 in the morning, which meant Randy would get the kids up to get them off to school. Anyway, I started volunteering at the school because I thought I should. But I feel sick the whole time I was there. Like I was shaky because I was not well. And I thought, can they tell? Can they tell? And they loved watching me work with the kids. I'd bring the babies with me, and they'd be fine, you know, while I was helping in Josh's class. And the teacher said, you know what? Not only are you good with the kids, but your own children obey you when you're here. And she says, you ought to become a sub. And, you know, I had kind of turned away from teaching. I hadn't really liked it all that much, and I hadn't planned to return, but something rang in my head like, you know, someday Randy could leave you again, and you better be ready, girl. You know, really and truly, I just knew I didn't really want to teach, but I knew I had to support myself because the 2 times I'd been abandoned, there had been no money. And so I thought, well, I'll take the C-Vest If I pass that, then that means God's in this. So I drove the icy roads to Susanville, took the CBEST, passed it, and then we moved to Chico. I could continue my schooling and, you know, try to get marketable. And, you know, Forrest was born while we were up there in the mountains. Anyway, then we moved to Chico, and that's when we started attending here. Now, if you had looked at me here, you didn't know all that, right? No clue. What happens is if you don't choose to let go of some of that, you become very self-contained. It's the only way I could survive. I became very, self-possessed in a way. I just knew if I said one thing, it'd all come out. You know, in the church, we don't talk about adultery, especially in the past. I could not talk about that I didn't tell my friends. The only time I told a friend, she was like, you know, and I thought, I'm not doing this again. It's too dangerous. And I knew, Randy, if it was known here, that you knew you'd be more hesitant about us as a family. You know, I just found it a very hard thing to deal with. It wounded me like a knife in my heart that, you know, I forgave him, but that doesn't mean there wasn't still pain. And when I said I didn't understand it all, that's because I never knew, the fundamental thing I never knew what to do with was my pain. All the other spiritual things I understood quite well. But even when I pray, I prayed for Randy so faithfully, I really believed God could restore and would change him. And that kept me going too. And I prayed for my kids. I wanted my kids to be good kids. And I thought, if I have to work hard for that to make that happen, I will. And I did. I probably did 80% of the parenting because Randy worked nights, you know, and wasn't very available. About this time, when we were attending here, the next really hard thing aside from my marriage happened. I mentioned there are five kids in my family. My youngest sister, Lois, had always been my greatest fan. Lois was the one who would say, Norma, hey, you're looking good. I really like that outfit. Or, hey, I'm glad you're going after your credential. You know, she was kind of like the cheerleader, you know. Well, I got this call. It was my brother-in-law, Dan. You know it. Something's wrong by the voice. And I thought, oh, no, I hope it's not another one of their children. He said, it's Norma, I have bad news. It's Lois. She's dead. And then he was still silent. He said, but that's not all. She committed suicide. Immediately, I knew I had to be with my parents. My parents had never faced anything like that in their lives. I mean, we were a good family. And so I can't even remember who watched the kids, but I came directly over to Mom and Dad's. When I arrived, my brother was arriving. And we just hugged each other, and he just shook his head like, you know. We went in, Mom and Dad. Mom was crying, and I can't believe it, that feeling. And we couldn't believe it. Lois was kind of like LaVon. Just beautiful. She was smart, and she conducted herself well. She was 33. She bought her own home. She was still single. She worked as a top executive secretary for one of the companies in Portland, the computer companies. She was well respected for what she did. But we knew she had walked away from her faith. She had shared that with the family a couple of years before that she wasn't believing anymore. So we had been praying, really praying hard that Lois would come back. And we'd been really concerned. And I'd had a call from her maybe 3 months before she died, and she had said, Norma, I just got to tell you about this. She was so excited. She says, I'm going to this retreat, I can't remember what she called it. She says, and it is so helpful. She says, it's really helping me with my struggles, because she sort of was depressed at times. And I thought, wow, she sounds different. She was so alive, so vibrant. I thought, why didn't Christianity do that for her, was my thought when I got off the phone. And now she was gone, you know, 3 months later. And So when we drove up, I can't tell you the sorrow of my family. We were totally devastated. Just nothing like that could we ever have conceived have happening in our family. So on the way up, we stopped at that one rest area that has the, you know, the water going by. And LaVon and I walked out by the water, and LaVon goes, "Oh, Mom," she said, "I just wish that Lois, Aunt Lou, is what they called her, Aunt Lou was Sleeping Beauty, and her prince would come and kiss her, and she would wake up." And then when we went to Marilyn's kitchen, Josh took the refrigerator magnets, and he wrote, "Aunt Lou still loves us." And it was hard, really hard. At the funeral, there was a group of people. There were Lois's friends from college who had loved the Lord. And then there were her new friends, her new age friends. The new age friends were not very sad. But they said it was her choice. It was her choice. They were very unfeeling about it. It was like, "That's okay." And one of them said, "Well, we kind of thought you guys were the problem because of her religious background." That was hard. And then we learned other things that were really hard. We found out she wasn't such a good girl. And we learned about an organization she had joined up with that was secretive, I think cult-like. But it was one of those, remember there used to be these things where you go to retreats, and she had this big binder, and it talked about how you need to leave your family if they're Christian or Jewish. And that it was like an enlightenment, and that you should break all ties with them because they will hold you down. And then we understood that she had been trying to break away. She left us a note. And in the note, she had something to each of us, to me, to her nieces and nephews. And she said, at the bottom line, it was something like, "You know, when I quit believing in God, I realized life wasn't worth living." Which is true, isn't it? It's not worth living without God. The funeral was so hard. And at the end, they sang "Amazing Grace." And it was years before I could sing that song. It was a sorrow. I never thought I could be happy again after she died. Life goes on, doesn't it? And with our very private family, it's always been something you couldn't really talk much about. It's in a sense like a failure. But I believe her death wasn't in vain. And I'm praying for some of those people that were cold-hearted. She also had bought into the Hemlock Society. She had their book and followed their directions for how to end her life, and it was on her bed. She did everything they said to do, and they even had a message on her message phone saying, talking to her. And so it was real. You can just get so upset by these things. Well, we came back, of course, to hear it. Yeah, so that just added one more thing I didn't understand. I just didn't really understand. Then, of course, the end of the story is that about Mandy leaving. Actually, when Glorianne was a year old, he got involved with someone. It was the day before her birthday, had a birthday party planned, and I figured it out, and they figured it out. And it was someone I knew from the youth group I had attended as a child, from a good Christian family. When that happened, we were 2 months away from a big family get-together. I thought, I can't ruin this for my family. And so we decided that we would go on, like we'd going on, until the end of the Sun River trip. And then we would decide whether we were what was going to happen. That gave me time to think, what did I really think should happen? Those 2 months were hard. I told no one. No one. Not my family. At about 9 years maybe before the marriage ended, I made a choice to never talk about my marriage anymore. What was the point? So I just suffered in silence. And in fact, my dad had said, "Well, things are better now, Norma, aren't they?" I said, "No, not really. I just wasn't talking." When we got back from Sun River, I gave Randy the choice of, "We can say this if you'll go see a counselor, a good counselor, and get to the get to the fundamental issue. And he said, okay, I'll go if you'll go with me. So we went, and it did help. He had some real issues. And lest you be harsh on Randy, let me tell you what was going on in my mind all these years. I had all the advantages growing up. Randy did not have the advantages. In fact, his mother would lock him out of the house till 10 at night, him and his siblings. Both parents slept around at home. The kids were there. They'd bring their lovers home. He hadn't had any of the things I had. I guess maybe it's that sort of rescuing. You know, I wanted him to be what he needed to be. So we kept going, but something in me had died. And the last 3 years before Randy left, I didn't have it anymore. I couldn't do it anymore. I was tired. So when he finally did leave, you know, it was devastating, but I didn't have the energy for it anymore. I do want to tell you how it was for my children, though, because you knew them, and you knew the marriage was falling apart. You probably didn't know. You didn't ask questions. I want to tell you this, because I think if you're contemplating divorce, you need to think about these things, what it does to other people. I figured it out a Saturday night. Randy had gone back to school to get his master's in psychology, and I was supportive of that because I thought he would maybe deal with his problems, and maybe he could get a better job. We'd been through 22 of them. I thought it was time. Anyway, he got together with a study group that would drive to Sacramento, and they were leaving their spouses, you know, realizing it was their spouse's problem. And I think up till that point, Randy always thought it was his problem. Then he started looking at what my problems were. So I confronted him. He admitted there was someone from work, who was a friend of this group. Amazingly enough, we embraced, and we both cried. I said, y'all have to tell the kids. That morning, instead of going to church, the kids got up and go, aren't we going to church? And he said, you'll have to sit on the couch. I have something to say. LaVon always quick goes, you're leaving, aren't you? He goes, yes, I am. And I'm not coming back. Well, why? They want to know why. And LaVon said, there's someone else, isn't there? And he didn't say, but that was probably because I said, you know, they don't need to know the particulars right now. Thomas wasn't there. He's in driver's education. And so they had the day to think about it while he was gone. Josh was up at Western Baptist College. Josh is here today. He's brave. Anyway, Randy called him, and it was hard. Josh later called us in the night, and he and LaVon just cried together on the phone. Anyway, when Thomas came home, Randy picked him up and brought him, told him the news. And Forrest and LaVon went out to be with Thomas. And they were out there a long time. I looked out the window, and they had their arms around each other crying. I thought, how could you? How could you do this to them? But they came in and they go, we thought we were different than other families. And now we're like, they're all our friends' families. And they were disillusioned. How could Dad preach one thing and do another? They were very angry, and I didn't know what to tell them. And that's where this church family is so wonderful. The pastor has answers. And when I've been through the abandonment in two other churches, they never knew what to do. They didn't know what to say. And they couldn't understand Randy. But pastor had answers for me. I said, do I tell the kids? I had hid them from all this. They thought they had a good family. You know, I was master at it. And pastor said, they're old enough. When they ask you, tell them. Tell them what they need to know. And so that is what happened. Slowly, at certain points, different ones asked me, and I told them. And then we went to the business of reconstructing my life. But Randy had left for good, and not only did he leave, he made a lot of accusations. And he told me, I just want to share this because he was a very shielded person. I never really knew what was going on there. I had learned to read his face. And I could tell when there was times you don't approach him. You know, that emotional struggles he had. But he never really told me what he thought. Well, the night before he left, he just leveled me. All the things he didn't like about ways I had been towards him and things I had done. And I thought, you know what? This is the first time I've ever seen who you really are. I thought, I wish I'd known these things. He had never told me. I didn't know those things. There's a lot of things we could have done differently if we had known, you know, what to do. But in my, I would say the number one thing is we stopped counseling too soon, and we still didn't deal with the fundamental issues. I'm going to close with this for today. When everything finally happened, and I was in that world of pain of rejection. You know, I had lost my job, too. You have to remember. Double rejection here. I thought, it seems to me that nice people finish last. Because I had tried so hard. And I felt like I was not good enough. What was wrong with me that he couldn't love me? Why didn't they like me at work? I tried so hard. I was broken. And I didn't understand God. Why didn't he reward faithfulness? But in that, I had to come to a place where I said, I don't care anymore. And I did. Bonnie said, you know, God, I tried it all I know. But I've never had joy. I've shared this with the women's ministry. What I longed for was joy. There are certain Christians who exude joy. I had deadness. I talked to remember Sharon Dix. I opened up with her because she had experienced unfaithfulness in her first marriage. And she said, Norma, it's like there's a knife in your heart and it just turns. And even when it's gone, the wound is still there. And it is. It will always be there. But I wanted healing. And, you know, I never knew I needed healing. I thought I was doing all the right things. And so I started to give it all up and started looking in the mirror and asking God for truth. I asked him to show me the truth about myself. I asked him to show me the truth about Randy, the truth about our marriage, and the truth about him, sincerely. And then I started writing my journal things, and I sought God for truth. And you know what? He started giving me truth. He did. And that's why when people, you come to me and say, oh, Norma, I see something. You know what? It's not me. It's not me anymore. It's God. Because when God finally freed me, when he healed those wounds, which I'll share with you next time how he did that, all of a sudden I was different. I just view Christianity as you add on certain behaviors, like reading your Bible and praying, doing the right things, going witnessing. And you remove certain behaviors, like the addictions, the lying. Then if you're obedient at those things, then you are living the good Christian walk, and you should have an abundant life. What I've realized that really is doing first. Where I have fundamentally changed, and what you have seen different in me now from what it used to be is no longer, it's doing first. What is first is an intimate relationship with God. And I look in the mirror and I see I've uncovered a lot of stuff I didn't know was there. And when the interesting thing is that when it becomes him, not you, then you don't have to do those things. They just happen. They just start coming. You know, I don't have to look for things to do. God gives them to me. He knows that I'll do them. But it's not trying to, you know, I put this in, I'll get that. It's not that anymore. It's just, I'm yours. I'm yours. And when you're his, in that regard, where you aren't trying, it's not striving anymore. It's being in this relationship with God. That is like a resting. Just rest. Rest in me, my child. He says, come unto me, all ye who labor and heavy laden, I will give you rest. I want you to take your bulletin out, and I'm going to read you how it seems to me. And then Pastor can come up here and pray. This is how I read this. Praise our God, O peoples. Let the sound of his praise be heard. He has preserved my life and kept my feet from slipping. For you, O God, tested me. You refined me like silver. I want to say, all those years of trusting Him were not in vain. I wouldn't be where I was if I hadn't gone through that. You let men ride over my head. I went through fire and water, and you brought me to a place of abundance. I will come to your temple with my offerings, and I will fulfill the vow I made to you. The vow my lips promised and my mouth spoke when I was in trouble, the thing I read to you. I will sacrifice my life, and I offer it to you. Come and listen, all you who fear God. Let me tell you what He has done for me. I cried out to Him with my mouth. His praise was on my tongue. If I had cherished sin in my heart. See, you know, there was a part of me that wanted to say, I'm going to get even. I'm going to go find me a man. Maybe I'm still pretty. Maybe. You know? And I'm going to get even. But I didn't do that. The Lord would have listened. But God has surely listened. And He heard my voice in prayer. Praise be to God, who has not rejected my prayer or withheld His love from me.
Hardware, looking forward to next time when we hear what you taught, Norma, and how the transformation has come. For we all need it. We all need it. Thank you for sustaining Norma through these difficult years, and sustaining her through this time of message. Now, God, we go away full, because we have seen with our eyes what you can do with someone who is fully surrendered to you. Dismiss us with your blessing. And all God's people say, give her a hug, will you?